This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:08 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day.
Number 5.
The government is looking for solutions to overcrowded schools.
The Education Ministry is currently exploring solutions to reduce congestion and ultimately improve the quality of education for students in 86 high-density schools across the country. One idea is to implement floating classes where available space such as workshops, labs and health rooms will be repurposed as classrooms.
So, I mean, that's interesting. And although it may provide some relief, it also may not be enough, because I think it's worth talking about the scale of the problem to get a sense of what we mean when we talk about high-density schools. So SMK Meru in Klang, for example, has 4,108 students and 240 teachers. So that's just a nutty ratio. And that is the most congested school in the country. So far, the ministry has decided for that school to build 8 new classrooms. But even in that context, I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud that there are so many. That's just, it boggles, the mind boggles.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we talked about recently was these under-enrolled schools, right? So clearly, populations are shifting, the placement and location of schools, maybe from a different period when it made sense, no longer makes sense. And the question is the kind of cost it's going to take for government to build more schools, which is kind of a natural thing. You're like, well, we'll just build more schools in those areas, right? But it's not going to be simple, because there's issues of land, there'll be issues of, the staffing and such. I mean, I don't know how the ministry is thinking about it, but they're clearly thinking about ways which do not include, I think, building more schools.
Yeah, so for instance, the Education Minister, Fadlina Siddiq, acknowledged that each school has its own challenges and therefore different solutions are needed for each situation. And if you talk about, for instance, year one students of SMK Cyberjaya, they're being transferred to other schools in the area as the government moves ahead with, as you were alluding to earlier, Sharad, construction of new classrooms and schools. So it sounds as if there are some longer term plans in the works, but in the meantime, they're also acknowledging that this is an immediate problem that needs some form of temporary solution, or, you know, just something to kind of tide things over.
Yeah, I for parents, I guess, placing your child in the school nearest to you is a priority. A school, that has a good reputation is probably one of those considerations. At any rate, it's not, I think, easy to just move people around, right? Because it really has an impact on how they live their lives and the quality of those lives, right? So if you're going to travel miles and miles to get to your school, that is not exactly an optimal solution either. So how that ministry is going to balance all these different stakeholders and their needs, a big problem indeed.
So tell us, the government is currently looking for solutions for overcrowding in schools. If you have thoughts on this, that number to call, 7733 2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number 4.
And now continuing the countdown on Top 5 at 5 and going from students to the elderly, unlicensed care homes for the elderly are in the news.
All right, about 2,000 old folks' homes are operating without license, according to the Residential Aged Care Operators Association President Delron Douglas. This, he said, is mainly because of the cumbersome bureaucratic processes, which, with approvals taking up to a year and renewals 6 months to complete. In addition, licensed centres must submit new applications every 5 years.
So the suggestion here is for the government to give unlicensed homes a grace period of 2 years to comply with regulations, especially considering the processes that you just talked about, Sharad. And during this time, Delron says that the aged care industry could gradually regulate itself, monitored closely by the welfare department. Now, this isn't coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, this call was mainly prompted by a recent case of abuse at an unlicensed elderly home in Padang Serai, Kedah. A video of the incident went viral. Now, both the homeowner and and the assaulter have been arrested. That's good news, I guess. After investigations were completed, the home will cease operations. Residents will be relocated to safer homes.
So to get a better understanding of the prevalence of this issue of unlicensed care homes, we reached out to Chai Sen Ting, who is a senior research officer from the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging at UPM.
Unlicensed care centres for the elderly has always been a major issue for decades. And while the Act 802 is still yet in force, it would do all key stakeholders a lot of good if they can come together and find a way to get unlicensed facilities or premises registered. We can talk about licensing and regulating old folks' homes and nursing homes according to their respective capacity to provide proper services for the elderly by qualified workers or volunteers. If we can rehabilitate illegal factories or, you know, pemutihan kilang haram, something can be done to fix the aged care situation so that everyone benefits. If we all can work together, then homes that have taken in elderly residents beyond their capacity to care can divert or redirect these patients to qualified facilities that can provide the right levels of care required.
He adds that there is a good reason why so many homes are unlicensed.
At the same time, we should bear in mind that if we overregulate or set too many rules and requirements for operators, they are just going to pass the cost to consumers. And then we'll all be back at square one because the ones who need public or private aged care services are families who are unable to care for their own elderly at home. There is a good reason why these unlicensed or unregistered facilities exist. And I do think it is a good idea to have some sort of a grace period or amnesty period, you know, to introduce a program or a scaffolding program to help these facilities and premises meet the minimum requirements of care.
That was Chai Sen Ting, Senior Research Officer from My Aging at UPM. If you have thoughts on this story, that number to call, 7733-2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. That was story number four, and we are going to continue the countdown on Top 5 at 5 after this, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters, BFM 89.9.
It is 5:15 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So we started things off at Story 5 about the government's proposal to solve overcrowding in schools. Story 4, the prevalence of unlicensed care homes.
Number 3.
This one's quite interesting, I think. About 100 KFC outlets have been suspended temporarily, I understand, after months of boycotts.
Right, so QSR Brands Holdings, which owns and operates a KFC fast food franchise in the country, has reportedly suspended 108 outlets nationwide. This is based on a report by Nanyang Xiaopao. They based this information from Google Maps, which showed KFC stores that had had their status updates to show that they are temporarily closed.
So QSR did release a statement yesterday saying that in response to what they call challenging economic conditions, they had to temporarily close outlets in order to manage growing business costs and focus on KFC stores that were actually receiving more customers.
Yeah, so no mention of the boycott, right?
No.
Right. Okay, in a report by the Straits Times, who went on a check on three outlets in Kuala Lumpur, signs were found at the stores indicating temporary closure, and boxes were seen stacked up inside the restaurants. It was also reported that Kelantan is the hardest hit of with these closures, with 21 outlets suspended, followed by 15 outlets in Johor.
Now, just so you know, there are more than 600 KFC restaurants in Malaysia, according to the QSR site. And KFC, as well as a few other brands, like, as we know, Starbucks, McDonald's, have been facing boycotts because of their perceived link to Israel amidst the Palestine-Israel siege. And I think it is worth saying also at this point that KFC is not in fact on the BDS list, and therefore that idea of perception is quite important. The fact that it is an American fast food chain, the fact that it is perceived to be kind of in the same club as these others appears to be what's hitting them here, because they're not, again, on the official list.
Yeah, so I think there's still some uncertainty as to the reasons why, and, you know, we'll take maybe a bit more searching and research to find out why exactly. But I think what is clear is that there's going to be consequences for workers, right? And so QSR did say that employees from the affected stores were offered the option to relocate. So we reached out to Liao Ho Eng, a lawyer specializing in employment law from Donovan & Ho, who shared his thoughts on what happens to affected employees.
The question would be whether is there any impact on employees who aren't offered reassignment or who refuse the reassignment. For example, will they be asked to agree to salary cuts or a paid leave? In Malaysia, we don't have a concept of furlough, which is a temporary leave of employees at the request of the employer, which is usually done without pay or with reduced pay, and it is usually also done on the basis of the employer's economic conditions. If employees are terminated or laid off because of the closure, then they may be entitled to statutory benefits, provided if they are eligible under the Employment Act 1955 or in accordance to the company policy. The best case scenario would be that the employees are reassigned to other branches and continue to work without any major change to their employment terms.
That was Liao Ho Eng, a lawyer specializing in employment law. If you have thoughts on the story, again, this is about 100 KFC outlets suspended, presumably due to months of boycotts affecting business. Let us know what you think. That number to call, 7733-2900. That number to send a voice note to or to WhatsApp is 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number two.
Continuing the countdown to top story on Top 5 at 5 and ratcheting up the controversialness, I think, with every news story. Che Gubat, Bersatu activist Che Gubat, charged again today in Johor under the Sedition Act.
Right, so just to get you up to speed, in case you're not aware of this whole story, Badrul Hisham Shahrin, better known as Che Gubat, was first charged yesterday in Kuala Lumpur for the same offence that he was charged in JB today. The case involves a Bloomberg report alleging that the Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim, met with Berjaya founder Vincent Tan and Genting Group CEO Lim Kok Tay to discuss a casino licence for Johor's Forest City project.
So the report, which quoted unnamed sources, said that a casino was mooted to revive the $100 billion property project. The current Agong, who is Sultan of Johor, has a business stake and has expressed concerns about the need to revitalize the project by various means, including having the Singapore KL high-speed rail go through it. And several months ago, the Prime Minister had also suggested that Forest City become a financial hub.
So this is where Che Gubat comes in. He responded to this report on Facebook, writing that the casino was the financial hub that Anwar had previously announced. And thanks to Bloomberg and Singapore's Business Times, thank Bloomberg and Singapore Business Times for their reports. Anwar, as well as heads of Berjaya and Genting, has since denied these claims, with the Prime Minister calling for action against the news agency and Berjaya Corp also having lodged a police report.
All of which ended up with yesterday Che Gubat being charged under the Sedition Act, which carries a punishment of a maximum fine of 5,000 ringgit, a jail term of up to 3 years, or both. So we reached out to Zaid Malik, Director of Lawyers for Liberty, for his thoughts.
It is utterly ridiculous that Che Gubat was charged under Sedition Act for the Facebook post that he made, because ultimately, what was the source of the Facebook comment? It was the Bloomberg news article. If the government is claiming that it is false, then it makes no sense for them to go after Che Gubat, because the news will not dissipate. They should have gone to the source and asked either for a clarification or a retraction. There is no sense to go after an individual who was merely responding to the news that was reported in an international news organization. Anyone could have done that. So it brings the question as to why the government had decided to take action against an individual and using a draconian law that they have promised to repeal. It sends a chilling message to anyone to not use or to not comment or criticize the government, because if you do so, then you may be subject to the investigation under the Sedition Act or any other the other draconian laws that they have yet to repeal.
That was Zaid Malik, Director of Lawyers for Liberty.
Yeah, so actually the related case this afternoon, actually noon, one Muhammad Aris Wanderes, better known as Papagomo, was arrested at his home, allegedly for making statements in a video suggesting that the Agong had instructed authorities to charge Che Gubat under the Sedition Act.
So I think it's early days yet to in knowing exactly where this is going to go. As we know, these sorts of cases, court cases in general, do take a long time. Investigations take a long time. But it is interesting. And I think it's interesting for a number of reasons, some of which have deep roots in Malaysian society and culture. For instance, the question of Sedition Act, its use, who it is used against, how it gets deployed or employed. Those questions are interesting. When the Agong took the position also, assumed the position, I think there were also these sorts of worries from before, not so much about the abuse of any sort of law, but the question of business interest.
Yeah, business interests are very important, I think, in sort of understanding the dynamics in this, because Forest City, you know, once touted as this major, you know, real estate development, has, you know, kind of floundered on several changes internationally, one of China's restrictions on capital going out of the country and so on and so forth. And all this happening many years ago. So if you go to Forest City today, it's, you know, seen as a ghost town. This story, interestingly enough, is picked up in the South China Morning Post just today with the headline said, suggesting that Anwar has rather calls from, media advocates calling on the Prime Minister and also Genting and Bajaj not to prosecute this case, because they're not just going after Che Gubat, they're also now lodging reports against the news agencies themselves for that unnamed source.
So if you have thoughts on this kind of tentacle story, that there's a number of different strands here that we could pursue, that number to call, 7733 2900. You can also, of course, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Top 5 at 5. We'll be back for our biggest story of the day, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
Ooh, it is exactly 5:38 and you are listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. Now, quick recap before we get there. Story 5, solutions to overcrowded classrooms. Story 4, unlicensed elderly care homes. Story 3, the temporary closure of 100 KFC stores. Story 2, sedition charges against Che Gubat. And we have been asking you for your thoughts on these issues. Let's start with schools. So Azami says, one solution, terminate all those incompetent school planners and deadwood in the civil service.
Azami, I think I can hear cheers going up, across the land for a solution like that. But because that doesn't seem fair to, maybe not even adequate to the problem, right? We don't know if the issue really is incompetent planners, because many schools were planned many years ago when the landscape was very different. The demographic landscape was different. The needs of middle-class Malaysians were different. And the options in terms of schooling had changed as well. So it might be less about incompetence, more about the inability to constantly renew the planning, right? And and keep up with current changes.
Yeah, so also, I suppose this is, if anything, a much more long-term solution. This is clearly not something that is that's going to help in the immediate sense, right? Because, again, I'd like to point out, yes, we can kind of point fingers and, you know, talk about who did what wrong. But right this very moment, in a school in Klang, there are 4,108 students. And firing people, I think, at this moment in time is simply not going to help these students. Like, there need to be other more constructive solutions in the short term, at the very least, for them and students like them. Sufian says, most urban schools did quite well during the MCO, using digital devices to learn from home. In a time when 50% of students took turns to go to school and study at home, it might be worth revisiting what we learned during that time to rethink new ways of learning outside the classroom.
Oh, this is interesting, Sufian. I mean, if you're suggesting that the overcrowding might be relieved somewhat by classes now just going online, you know, and therefore putting that as part of the schedule, that may work. And I think coming back to what the minister suggested is that actually each school is unique in its problem and in the solutions that it can afford to put in place, right? So it needs a much more bespoke kind of a response. Let's hope the ministry and the people in it, you know, together with stakeholders, find adequate solutions that kind of guarantee quality of education.
Now, on the subject of unlicensed care homes, Willa says, JKM must view NGO-run homes as partners and help them in the registration process. It's tedious. Support letters from certain authorities take a long time. Registration is important to regulate facilities for vulnerable people.
Yeah, I don't know how would you feel about this, Lynn. But so you know, there's this thing, right? You don't want a lack of regulation because it can lead to all kinds of abuse. But yeah, then you can overregulate something to the extent that it paralyzes not just innovation, but just things starting up and disincentivizes people from getting into that field, right? People,
yeah,
like, who's going to start an old folks' home if it's so difficult to start one?
Yeah, this is also tough because it's interesting that there are two mirrors. Stories, right, that on the one hand we've got this issue of overcrowding in schools affecting young people, and then unlicensed care homes obviously affecting the old. And I think it kind of reflects the ways in which we maybe haven't our country hasn't adapted to its people's needs, because we're an aging society, we're heading into a super age society. There's every reason to believe that we will probably need more care homes than fewer. And so with that, I guess from the government's perspective, it's going to become, can everything be state run, right? So can the state provide that much care for that many aged people? If it can't, then how can it provide the most regulated support for people to enter the space? And I don't know. I mean, surely there's a middle ground.
Yeah, there must be. I mean, look, because this happens in many countries. I mean, I can't imagine a situation where, you know, somebody comes and buys up an aging hotel and turns all the hotel rooms into... So can you imagine if, you know, the elderly live in assisted care, but essentially what a structure that used to be a hotel? I mean, I think there's all kinds of possibilities. At the end of the day, it's going to be about money, I guess, because you got to fund this, right? And it's got to be sustainable. And where's the support coming from? Will there be tax breaks? Will families wanting to, who can't afford to look after their parents now and or elderly, be able to afford the kind of care that's being brought up? So the rich are always going to be lucky because they're going to get super quality and all that. But what about the bulk of people needing the service? Is there going to be the ability to provide that at a price that makes sense, right, for families?
Keep those thoughts coming. You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we will return for the biggest story of the day. So do keep it here on Top 5 at 5, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It's 5:46. You are listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the biggest story of the day, which is exactly where we've landed.
Number one.
Pothole payout. So a motorcyclist has been granted 721,000 ringgit for damages to for his injuries, as well as for damages to his motorcycle after his bike hit a pothole 3 years ago. Now, I think this is just such an amazing story for a multitude of reasons, partly because everyone has experienced these kind of frightening potholes. And I think in those moments, you always wonder, what could have happened, right? Like, there's so many kind of dangerous things that could have happened, and some of it is dependent on your familiarity with the road, so on and so forth. You hear these horror stories, and now we have seen this kind of this happen, this court case.
Yeah, and you know, before one starts to break out the champagne and think, oh, you know, well, this person's going to be partying, you know, till, you know, well, I'm going to say 1999, but because we've gone past that year. But you know what I mean? It's the reason why the payout seems so large is because the damage it did to this person's body, to his ability to earn money.
Yes.
Long into the future, right? And so, and also the fact that they're reoccurring costs with surgical procedures he's going to have. So this is not some frivolous amount. I think when we read the report in full about the breakdown as to why he got 700,000. So, also coming back to your point, Lynn, about the terrifying potholes, much more terrifying for cyclists
yes.
and motorcyclists. And then the number of times I've read of people losing their lives because of a pothole, this, I hope, turns the tide. And that's going to make everybody more accountable.
Well, yes, and accountable to fix it quick, because part of why the company was held liable is because the Sessions Court discovered that no work had been done to fix the potholes from the day of the accident, which I think was in 2021, until September 29th, 2022. So that's, you know, I think that just kind of is something most people would expect to hear, and yet is still so deeply disheartening. So there's a lot to get into. If you'd like to weigh in on this payout of 721,000 ringgit for a man who had been injured and because of an accident after his bike hit a pothole, that number to call, 7733 2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Speaking with us now, we have Salim Bashir, lawyer and former president of the Malaysian Bar. Salim, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's first talk about the motorcyclist who was granted that 721,000 ringgit. What was your reaction to the news?
It's interesting. This is a perennial problem facing the road users. So I'm joined by the judgments of the Sessions Court. You see, when accident happened due to unworthy road conditions, the users may end up having a high cost of repairs to their vehicles, or worse still, if they suffer some kind of a serious injuries or even death. So this decision actually serves a clarion call to the responsible parties and authorities to fulfill their obligations in maintaining roads. And this as well gives rise to public awareness of their rights under the law in a situation if they face this kind of similar situations in the future.
Salim, does this verdict set a precedent? I mean, are we going to, can we expect more claims to be made of this sort, not just for future accidents, but for things that happened in the recent past?
Yeah, to make it very clear here, this is not a first time ever that we have the court have meted out such a decision. It happened before. Even if I'm not mistaken, in some way in 2009, the court have awarded compensation for damages and injuries suffered by the road user due to the potholes. Okay? So there were also other cases in the past that the court have taken a similar approach. The amount that they ordered is quite high, I would say. But that actually depends with the kind of injuries suffered by the claimant, and also the damages to the vehicle and so on.
So talk to us then about how these sorts of compensation amounts are typically determined. I mean, what were the factors in calculating the damages that were sustained?
Mm-hmm. Okay. The compensations are calculated based on losses suffered by the claimant. It weighs on the extent of injuries, damages incurred, and it's also the emotional distress and suffering. So these are the kind of losses that will be taken into account by the courts before they arrive and award an amount as the damages.
So I understand that, at least in the reports, the court granted damages, special damages and general damages for a kind of a non-lawyer type. I mean, could you explain the distinction between these two types of damages?
Okay. Special damages are quantifiable and can their losses can be ascertained. For example, like medical expenses. Maybe he would have gone to the hospital, to the private centres. He would have incurred expenses travelling to the hospitals. He got he would have rented car to go to the hospital. So all these bills can be quantified, can be produced in court as an evidence to show that he suffered and he have incurred losses because of this accident. And it's also at times that he need to stay home, he would have lost wages. And that is also quantifiable if you're able to prove that he is, he's out of a job and he's not paid salary and so on. And future surgeries, if the medical experts come to court and testify that this particular Mr. A needs future surgeries and the cost of the future surgeries is an amount that to be proposed will be such, then that particular amount will be also considered as special damages for it to be awarded to the claimants. And as far as general damages are concerned, it is non-ascertainable. For example, like you cannot quantify, you cannot put a price tag on it. The quantification are based on the kind of injuries sustained. For example, like he had a head injury. He have and his hand need to be amputated for some reason. So these are the kind of injuries that will be awarded under the general damages. You cannot put a price tag on someone's limb. If the person is a football and he loses his leg, you cannot put a price tag on it because Mr. A would be a footballer and he needs the leg for his leg for survival. Compared to Mr. B, who is not a footballer, and his amount of his damages would have been much lesser compared to Mr. A. And it's entirely based on the expert testimonies and the evidence in the past for the court to take into account what is the kind of amount of damages to be awarded for general damages.
So in this case, the motorcyclist proved that the company was negligent because it hadn't conducted any repairs on the road between the day of the incident in 2021 until the next year. Can you talk to us about what evidence is required to prove negligence?
Okay. Based on the fact that, you know, that if you want to prove there is a pothole and you suffered an injury due to that, and you must prove the existence of the pothole itself. That is one. Snap as much photos as you need. Okay, to prove that it's a pothole. Because you never know, you know, today you go and hit a pothole and you suffer an injury, tomorrow the authorities come to know and the fire contractors come to know and you're going to surface it and you may not have a proof. So immediately after you face that kind of consequences, you stick as much photos as you want and you possibly produce eyewitnesses and other corroborative value, corroborative evidence to prove your case. And this is very much needed for you to prove your claim in court.
Now, what we understand is the suit was initially brought against the state government as well as the company, but that part of it was withdrawn. Can you help us understand the decision to withdraw the suit against the state government? Should the state be held responsible?
Oh, of course. If you look at the Section 5 of the Government Proceedings Act, government will be liable for any wrongful act done on negligence to some extent. If it is done by their agent, so the government can be held vicariously liable for the act of their agents, and under the Street Drainage and Building Act as well, the local authorities are responsible to maintain and repair the public streets. And under Section 7. Section 7, sub 3 of the Government Proceedings Act also says that the government can be held liable for negligence or trespass in the execution of works or construction in maintaining public roads undertaken by the government. So these are the kind of the law that is in place to say that the government have a duty to maintain public walkways and public roads.
So,
the reason why the case was withdrawn against the government is entirely in the hand of the plaintiff. They decided to withdraw against the government and they want to have the private company responsible. That is entirely on the plaintiff's discretion to do that.
We have a couple of minutes left with you. In closing, what legal action can victims take? What rights do they have if they do encounter a pothole and get into an accident, get injured, sustain damages, and so on?
They can file a lawsuit, a similar lawsuit, under the law of tort law of tort is wrongful action. It must be compensated as civil action that resulted in one be harmed or causing injury. So under the civil law, you can actually file the law of tort action to claim compensation from a private entity or even the government.
Salim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That was Salim Bashir, lawyer and former president of the Malaysian Bar, speaking to us about the more than $700,000 payout that a motorcyclist has been granted for damages to himself, really, and his motorcycle after his bike hit a pothole 3 years ago. Now, we've been asking you for your thoughts, and I think that, well, Raz says, so actually who pays? It's the taxpayers, while those responsible get away scot-free. You know, I think the local authorities are incompetent.
Yeah, Raz, I think in this case, because the local authority was not part of the suit, because that was withdrawn, it's actually the private company that's going to be paying up, this time at least.
Although, yes, that's right. And I think this, however, kind of gets at the frustration that people feel about the prevalence of potholes, that's one. But beyond the prevalence, it's the speed with which they get fixed or don't appear to.
Yeah, and because the consequences are so dire, it's not just a hole in the ground, it's a hole that can kill somebody. And therefore, you know, you expect the utmost urgency in repairing roads for the, you know, the safety of the public.
Keep those thoughts coming. You can call us, send us a voice note or WhatsApp. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.